France pauses to mourn today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. All of France observed a minute of silence to remember those killed in the Paris attacks. This Parisian paused while she was donating blood.
All of the people in Paris are very united. We are just the same, yes.
Also, investigators turned their attention to a neighborhood in Brussels where many of the alleged attackers lived.
You have a lot of disaffected young people who feel pushed to the margins of mainstream society. Unfortunately, some of them have fallen prey to radicalization.
Plus, why bombing ISIS strongholds is just one of the goals in Syria.
As long as we can't agree on what to do about Assad, then we can't really resolve the ISIS problem.
Those stories coming up today on The World. We've been trying to make sense of the tragic events in Paris all weekend. For many of us, it's personal. The places that were attacked are familiar to anyone who's visited that city. But it goes beyond familiarity. There's the heartbreak of so many lives ended abruptly and violently last Friday night. Plus, the Paris attacks appear to have moved a battle being waged in Syria and across the Mideast into a Western city. And that raises many, many questions and challenges with an urgency that is undeniable. We're going to start asking some of those questions today, and we'll be asking them over the coming days and weeks. Today, we begin our coverage in Paris. At 12 noon today, the city and all of France came to a halt for a minute's silence to remember those killed in the attacks. The World's Leo Hornack is in Paris. He spent the morning at a blood donation center in the city's Saint-Louis Hospital, directly opposite two of the bars where people were killed by gunmen on Friday.
Amandine has never given blood before, and she says she's nervous. She doesn't like needles. But she's here on a grey Monday morning with dozens of other people because she wants to do something.
I'm proud to do this, and I think it's important in this time.
The blood centre is packed with people like Amandine, people who want to make a difference. On Saturday, more than 2,000 people offered to donate their blood in the Greater Paris region, three times the normal number. A third of them, like Amandine, for the first time ever. Friends of hers were killed on Friday.
I think all of the people in Paris are very united, and I think we are just one. There isn't different. We are just the same, yes.
Here in the Saint-Louis clinic, there's a line out the door and into the parking lot. To cope with the crush, one of the nurses has come in on her day off. She's drawing blood with her sleepy toddler strapped to her back. There's another reason the atmosphere is intense at this particular donation centre. Nurses and doctors at this hospital were among those having drinks across the street on Friday when one of the gunmen opened fire. 15 people died, with 10 more seriously injured. As the minute of silence approaches, we head outside to the corner where it happened. Hundreds of people have now gathered, standing quietly in the street. Some weep. A woman kneels and prays. There are so many candles burning on the sidewalk, you can smell the candle wax in the air. The minute silence starts. And goes on. 2 minutes. 4 minutes. 6. It's as if no one can bear to break this moment. And then this happens. People begin applauding. And a voice, somewhere in the crowd, begins to recite a poem by a Senegalese poet. The dead are not under the ground. They're in the fire that goes out. They're in the grass that cries. They're in the rock that moans. They're in the forest. They're in the house. The dead are not dead. Listen. For The World in Paris, I'm Leo Hornack.
Powerful, powerful moments there earlier today in Paris. Investigators are still piecing together exactly how the attacks were planned and carried out on Friday, but already they've been able to trace a number of suspects, including the plot's alleged mastermind, to Belgium. Many of them spent time in a specific neighborhood in Brussels called Molenbeek. The area has a reputation as a breeding ground for extremism. Paul Ames, with our partners at Global Post, has reported from Molenbeek before. I asked him if it surprises him to hear about the Belgium connection.
No, it doesn't surprise me. In fact, over the past few years and months, a number of international terrorist cases have been traced back to Molenbeek. The gunman who tried to intervene on the high-speed train between Brussels and Paris recently this year in August, he was believed to be living in Molenbeek. Another gunman who killed four people at the Jewish Museum in Brussels last year, last August, was also living in that neighborhood. And two other terrorists who were suspected terrorists who were shot by Belgian police in January also had links there. So the neighborhood has a long and troubled history with this sort of radicalized people.
All right, so take us to Molenbeek. What do you see when you go there?
Yeah, well, Molenbeek, it's actually not on the outskirts of Brussels. It's very close to the city center. It's just a short walk away over a canal. There's a bridge linking it to the city center. So on one side of the canal, you have central Brussels. You have very nice cafes and shops. It's quite a trendy area. Whereas over the bridge, you have Molenbeek. It's an inner city neighborhood. It's a neighborhood which has a large Muslim population. About half of the population is of Moroccan origin. And it's actually a very, very lively neighborhood. There are lots of Moroccan patisseries selling pastries. There are lots of cafes where you see men sitting on the terraces drinking mint tea. It's very colorful. Lots of fabric stores there. But it has a fearsome reputation in Belgium. It's reputed to be, beside the idea of Islamic extremism, it also has a high crime rate. Women in particular complain that they're often harassed in the streets if they cross over there. So many residents from other parts of Brussels, particularly the international city, if you like, people working at the European Union or at NATO or other large international institutions, rarely cross over that bridge and go into the Molenbeek neighborhood.
In the past, some people in Belgium have called this neighborhood Molenbeek. That sounds like it could be tinges of racism, and I don't want to paint Molenbeek with a giant brush. But can you tell us what it is about Molenbeek that makes it a hotbed for extremism, if that is in fact the case?
Well, as I said, it's one of the poorest neighborhoods in Brussels. Particularly among the young people, unemployment is very, very high there. It's running at almost 40%. So you have a lot of disaffected young people who feel alienated. They feel somehow pushed to the margins of mainstream society in Brussels. And therefore, they are, unfortunately, some of them have fallen prey to radicalization. Now, community leaders in Molenbeek are very keen to point out that this is a tiny minority. The population of Molenbeek is about 95,000 people. As I said, about half of them are Muslims, mostly of Moroccan origin. And community leaders say that, you know, there are good things going on in that community. There are good things going on culturally. There are good things going on socially. It's not a black hole of extremism. But unfortunately, there is this small number of youths who have been radicalized in there. And there are criticisms. If you speak to security experts, there have been criticisms of the way the Belgian authorities have handled this. They say that there's been a certain lax approach to some of the radical preaching that goes on there, and this has allowed radical cells to recruit people to go and fight in Syria, or, as it seems, looking at some of these reports we're seeing now, to carry out terrorist attacks in Europe.
Paul, how do you reckon attacks like the one on Friday in Paris affect the psyches of residents in Molenbeek, especially now that eyes are on them? Are they worried about what comes next?
Yeah, I was just reading a distressing article in one of the local papers there today about how, you know, parents in Molenbeek are trying to explain to their children what's going on as they see police flooding into the neighborhood. You've got special forces heavily armed climbing on the rooftops as they've launched operations against homes there. It must be an extremely distressing time for, as I said, for that vast majority of people living in Molenbeek who are ordinary citizens and want to get on with building their lives.
Reporter Paul Ames with our partners at Global Post speaking with me about the Belgian neighborhood of Molenbeek. Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
If Friday's deadly attacks in Paris are in fact the work of ISIS, then this is the concern. This extremist group that appeared rooted in the chaos of Iraq and Syria has a new global strategy. I want to ask J.M. Berger about that. He co-authored ISIS, The State of Terror. First of all, J.M., it's difficult to know this with certainty aside from a claim of responsibility from the group. But from what you've seen so far, should we be describing the Paris attack as the work of ISIS?
I think there's very strong indications that it is the work of ISIS. I think there's a vanishingly small chance that this attack was carried out by Al-Qaeda or another jihadist group.
Yeah, so that if that is the case, does Paris represent a real game changer? Is ISIS trying something different?
Well, we've seen ISIS carry out bombings abroad before, most notably in March in Yemen, where they bombed the Shia mosques in Sana'a. What we've seen is that ISIS is really pursuing a strategy of escalating provocations. While they had hostages, they didn't need to leave their borders to provoke the West and provoke countries in the region. But now they're moving toward a more of a terrorism model. And it's not just Paris. What we've seen is in the last little over 2 weeks, we've seen three major terrorist attacks attributed to ISIS in places outside of Iraq and Syria.
I mean, they've said for a long time, right, that they're not just building a caliphate. They want the whole world to believe what they believe, right?
Yes. I mean, these attacks are not necessarily designed to win hearts and minds. I mean, there is an element of that. ISIS is making a very deliberate play for the very small percentage of people in the world who are inclined toward violence, you know, kind of violence junkies. And it wants those people to be energized and to emulate what they see in a kind of a copycat manner. This is also, I think, more finely tuned to increase the involvement of foreign powers in the Syrian civil war. Iraq and Syria, you know, are a flashpoint for what's happening here. Without the chaos in Iraq and Syria, we really wouldn't have an ISIS. The more countries that get involved with more competing agendas, the more complicated this conflict becomes and the harder it is to resolve. So I think that that's a deliberate part of their strategy.
Well, it didn't take long for France to start bombing Raqqa after Friday's attack. That would be the ISIS stronghold in northern Syria. But it sounds like you're saying almost that that's what ISIS wanted.
If you go back earlier this year into February with the capture of the Jordanian pilot who was burned alive, ISIS took some pressure from Jordan. Jordan agreed to join the coalition against it. They captured this pilot who was carrying out an operation against ISIS. They burned him alive, and Jordan immediately massed forces on the border of Iraq. And then ISIS began hitting them with suicide bombings, trying to lure them over the border. If the Jordanian forces had made an incursion into Iraq, it would have created huge complications with the Iraqi government and would have really escalated tensions. So I think that, you know, I think that that is really their game plan, is just to get as many players with competing agendas into the field as possible. And we can see how these competing agendas make it impossible, for instance, to resolve the Syrian civil war. We can't get anybody to agree what happens to Assad. And that is a huge asset for ISIS, because as long as we can't agree on what to do about Assad, then we can't really resolve the ISIS problem.
It doesn't sound like there are a lot of easy solutions here.
No, usually people don't come away from conversations with me with a smile on their face, unfortunately.
So today, ISIS releases a video saying Washington will also feel the pain like Paris. What do you make of that?
Well, we've seen threats against Washington all throughout. I mean, ISIS really has a very high tempo of verbal threats that it issues over social media and its video propaganda. It's not necessarily indicative of the fact that they have the capacity to strike in Washington. I would say that hitting in the United States with an attack similar to what we saw in Paris would be much more difficult for them, but I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility.
J.M. Berger, whose book ISIS, The State of Terror, came out earlier this year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up a bit later on The World, Paris isn't the only city that suffered devastating attacks at the hands of ISIS last week. Beirut did as well, and some people in the Lebanese capital wonder why there wasn't a global outpouring of grief for them. This doctor says he's not bitter, just resigned.
Over the years, we've come to grasp with the notion that we don't really matter in the global sense, and that we are third class citizens. It's still sort of not okay to be silent about it, at least in times like these, and it's always important to raise your voice.
More on that story coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. A Syrian passport was found next to the body of one of the Paris attackers last Friday night. It appears the gunman had come into Europe via Greece, posing as a refugee. And that's prompted some to say that refugees from Syria should not be welcomed in the West anymore. GOP presidential candidates Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, for example. In Turkey today, President Obama said his number one priority was to ensure the nation's security, but he made it clear the U.S. will not stop accepting refugees.
Slamming the door in their faces would be a betrayal of our values. Our nations can welcome refugees who are desperately seeking safety and ensure our own security. We can and must do both.
We'll hear more on the American debate over refugees in a few minutes. First, let's head to Greece, where hundreds of Syrian refugees continue to arrive daily. A popular entry point for many is the Greek island of Lesbos, and that's where reporter Jean Carstensen is. She says the discovery of that passport in Paris shows us how little the authorities there know about who's coming in.
This is an incident that shows the vulnerabilities in the registration process, how easy it is for anybody. We don't know who these people are, and they're arriving at these islands and they're moving on through.
I mean, given the number of people coming through Greece, it doesn't sound like you're surprised that a gunman may have been in the mix. Maybe you can just tell us from your kind of perch in Lesbos, remind us what those numbers of people coming ashore actually looks like.
Yes, it's business as usual here on Lesbos. We have about 3,000 people a day arriving in November, and that was about 4,000 in October. So the beaches are still receiving many, many of these rubber boats, sometimes the wooden boats. It's as if Paris does not exist on these beaches. People are coming because they need to come. They want to be here. They're still making this dangerous journey.
So lots of refugees and migrants passing through Greece, the vast majority, presumably, are people who are just running for their lives, not extremists. Are those refugees and migrants afraid these attacks in Paris could impact their chance at a new life?
I asked a few refugees that over the weekend, and really it's something they don't want to think about. When they arrive here on Lesbos, they've just done a very dangerous sea journey, and I think it's a moment when they hold on to hope. They want to believe that their chances are high. They've invested money. They've invested a lot in their dream of getting to a safer situation. So they really want to focus on that. I did not have conversations with anybody who at least cared to admit out loud that they thought their chances were less.
Yeah, got to keep hope alive. What about the residents of Lesbos? Since Friday, has there been any change in attitudes among them toward the migrants and refugees?
You know, not yet. I think we have to see how this is going to play out here and on the other islands. But so far, the daily chore of handling all of these people, imagine what it's like, 3,000, 4,000 people every single day, moving them across an island, making sure that they're not sick, dealing with shelter, food. It's such a huge operation that people just have to keep welcoming them and moving them through.
Finally, Jean, how do you think the attacks in Paris could change the way officials in Greece are dealing with migrants and refugees?
Well, I think we're all waiting to learn the answer to that question. So far, there has been no official change in policy. But if there is a change, it could change things here a lot. We could see more people left on this island, unable to move north. And I think that would cause terrible difficulties here and on the other Aegean islands.
Reporter Jean Carstensen there in Lesbos, Greece. The process to admit refugees here in the U.S. is much slower and could get slower still. Governors from several states, including Texas, have said they don't want to accept refugees from Syria. But today, the State Department said there's no change to the president's plan to admit 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year. That plan calls for resettling the refugees throughout the U.S. The World's Jason Margolis has been in Houston looking at how that happens.
The city of Houston has accepted perhaps the largest number of Syrian refugees in the U.S. since the civil war there began. Still, the numbers in the past year have been very small. Dario Lipovac oversees refugee resettlement for the YMCA of Greater Houston.
We resettled 14, to be specific, two families of five and one family of four.
All told, five local agencies have resettled about 100 Syrians over the past year in Houston. That number might not be getting bigger as of today. I spoke with Lipovac last week before the Paris attacks. Today, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, sent a letter to President Obama saying his state won't accept more Syrian refugees. To come to the U.S., refugees from any country first need to be screened by the Department of Homeland Security and the United Nations. This Syrian woman, Lena, went through that screening. She arrived in Houston with her husband and four children last December. They're from the Syrian city of Homs, a stronghold of opposition to the Syrian government. Her family fled to another Syrian city where they spent a year and a half. Then they spent a year and a half in Egypt. Eventually, they were relocated to Houston, a city they never heard of, where she knew no one. Wafa Abdin with Catholic Charities in Houston said it's a long process for refugees to get to the United States, and it's been especially slow with Syrians. Again, we spoke before the Paris attacks.
The whole political situation there, because of the rise of ISIS, most of the people who are coming are Muslims. So there is this, you know, idea we want to make sure absolutely they're not terrorists, they're not connected to them, they're not going to come to hurt the homeland. So as a result, very few are being approved.
Do you think that the U.S. government is processing people too slowly, or it's doing the necessary due diligence to keep us safe?
I mean, it's really hard to answer this question. I understand that this would be a huge concern, but at the same time, I personally think that these are people who are in dire need of help, and all we see coming are families with young kids.
Today, Catholic Charities said it could not comment on the Texas governor's call to close the door to Syrian refugees. But a spokesman, Jim Townsend, said via email, it's important to emphasize that not all Westerners are afraid of Syrians. And he added, the horrific tragedy in Paris is the sort of thing refugees are fleeing. Last week, I also spoke with Jeff Watkins with the YMCA in Houston. He said national security interests are very important, but need to be balanced with humanitarian interests. And he pointed out that trying to get to the U.S. through an official refugee resettlement program is not an efficient route for a would-be terrorist.
It would be like the lottery, literally, because 4 million Syrians to date have been forced to flee and have been identified as refugees. This year, if everything goes perfectly, a maximum of, 10,000 would come to the U.S. So those aren't good odds if your intent is to come to this country and cause harm.
I contacted him again today, but he couldn't comment on the governor's announcement. I asked the Syrian refugee I met, Lena, how she feels about many Americans being afraid of Muslims from her country. She said she spoke with me because she wants to clear the image of Muslims. She said we live in peace and are not terrorists. She said she wants to return to Syria when it's safe. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Houston.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Paris attackers targeted cafes and restaurants, a concert hall, and a soccer game. And that's left many in the city feeling extra vulnerable.
It's not the Eiffel Tower. It's not the Louvre Museum. It's not the metro. It's everybody, anybody, at any time, anywhere.
The mood in Paris ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. France, and Paris especially, are on edge today, 3 days after 129 people were killed in a series of coordinated attacks in Paris. Police are still searching for at least one attacker who appears to have gotten away. They're also looking for the alleged mastermind of the plot and possible accomplices. The investigation's main focus appears to have shifted to Belgium and a neighborhood in Brussels where several suspects are known to have lived. But in Paris itself, people are still struggling to cope with what happened on Friday. My former colleague here at The World, Adeline Cyr, is in Paris today. Thanks so much for joining us, Adele. It's been a dark weekend. Tell me how you are today.
Oh, it's a very strange day today because after hearing about this attack in this sort of a really eerie way, removed from the scene because I actually live about 100 miles from Paris at the moment, and I heard about it very late at night, and like everybody else, I watched it unfold on television. Here I am today, arriving in the city. I took the metro, and it was almost deserted, as you can imagine. And there was a real look of not just sadness on people's faces, but real pain. People were looking at their feet; they were not looking around. It was very, very quiet.
Have you ever seen Paris like this before?
No, I can't remember anything like this. I mean, it's just a really odd feeling to be walking around here and looking at those makeshift altars, you know, those little piles of flowers I saw just 150 yards away from where I'm staying at Le Carillon and Le Petit Cambodge, a cafe and a restaurant where about 15 people were shot dead last Friday. I was there today at noon for the minute of silence that was observed nationwide, and it turned into a mourner's quiet ceremony. People were crying, holding candles and bringing flowers. They sang or whispered, rather, La Marseillaise. It was really beautiful. There was a magical ray of sun on this gray day at that time, and it was just really moving, and everyone was so quiet. And like I said, you could just see sadness. People were crying, but people feel like, you know, they were really hurting.
It sounds really intense and poignant. Some of the events on Friday went down in the 11th arrondissement. You have family who live and work there. You know it as well as any neighborhood you're connected with. What does this part of Paris mean?
Yes, this really hits home for me because the entire Paris contingent of my family, my large French family, lives here in the 10th and 11th districts. They were all witnesses to what happened last Friday, unfortunately. In fact, one of my nieces, who is 23, she works at a bar near La Belle Équipe, the bar where 19 people were killed, Rue de Charonne. And so on Friday, she got caught in the middle of this horrific night. Thankfully, she was not hurt, but the bar where she works had to shut down precipitously. And she had to stay a good part of the night there with customers and even passers-by who were looking for a place to hide until the police told them it was safe to come out. So a scene that you would never imagine in the city.
How is she doing?
She's very much in shock. She says she's okay, but she was in touch with some of her friends who actually got to see the bloodiest part of the night. She did not. She was a little bit removed from it, but certainly this whole scene, this whole day is going to be something that will take a long time to overcome for a lot of young people in Paris.
One small detail about Friday night. Apparently, the weather was exceptional. Beautiful Indian summer and everyone was out. I mean, what does it mean to this neighborhood that it has come under attack?
You know, you really hit something very important here because it just feels so cruel that the people who were hit mostly were young people at the end of the work week enjoying an unusually warm evening on a Friday night. They work all week and they were just relaxing at outdoors cafes, you know, terraces. This is the Paris way of life.
You talked about how people in Paris are sad and quiet. What about fearful? And how are you feeling right now about your own security?
I spoke to a few people who told me, they all told me the same thing. They're certain it's going to happen again very soon for some reason. There's something, Marco, about this that is a real turning point. We're not talking about a political target or pseudo-political target. It's not Charlie Hebdo or, you know, unfortunately, the terrible choice of a kosher supermarket. It's just random people. And then there's just no limit to this, right? I mean, it's not the Eiffel Tower. It's not the Louvre Museum. It's not the Metro. It's everybody, anybody, at any time, anywhere. And I think in a way for me, I'm only beginning to realize I wasn't there on Friday, but I'm really catching up.
Adeline Sia in Paris, my former colleague here at The World. Thank you very much for your thoughts, Adele.
You're welcome, Marco. Take care.
The terrorist attacks on Paris are resonating with people around the globe. That's true for Eli Fares. He's a physician who blogs from Beirut. But it resonates for him because his own city came under attack last week, one day before Paris. ISIS claimed responsibility for two bomb blasts that hit a busy shopping street in Beirut. More than 40 people were killed, over 200 more injured. Dr. Fares, you've written that when people died on the streets of Beirut last week, it was not on the radar of world leaders. It did not command the same attention as Paris. Why do you believe that's the case?
I think it's because Beirut is a city that most people associate with violence and with war. And it's a city where they think what happened or the two terrorist attacks that occurred are everyday life. They think we're a city that where such a thing occurs every single day, which inherently means that such a thing is normal. And normality is often overlooked when you have anomalies taking place around it.
Yeah, so when you saw the reaction, people expressing their solidarity with the French victims, displaying the tricolored flag, how'd that make you feel?
Well, at first it made me feel good that there's this feeling of shared humanity, of common humanity among everyone, that regardless of where you came from, regardless of your country, of your time zone, of your race, of your religion, people were feeling sorry for the French victims. I thought that was very, very nice to see, but I mean, at least for the French. But then when you think that, when you put it in the context of my own city being torn apart by violence, which is not really commonplace for us anymore, it sort of changes how you look at things. And I mean, I'm not bitter. I'm not a bitter Lebanese. Over the years, we've come to grasp with the notion that we don't really matter in the global sense. I think enough random checks on airports do that to you. But it's still sort of not okay to be silent about it, at least in times like these. And it's always important to raise your voice by highlighting how different response to Paris versus the response to the attacks in my city were, and to try and say that, okay, let's talk about it.
Where do you find the strength to stay in Beirut?
I mean, it's not a war-torn city. It's a regular cosmopolitan city. It's the most liberal city in the Middle East. Life is normal, apart from the explosion that took place a couple of days ago. I mean, currently the malls are open, people are going to the movies. The new James Bond movie is a hit, even though it's horrible. And people go about their life. Everyone is waiting for the new Adele album. Life is normal. Right. Life is normal, apart from that explosion which took place a few days ago. And that sort of disturbed the sense of normality. The reputation is that we are a city at war. But the fact of the matter is we're pretty much at bay, especially given that a neighboring country, which is Syria, is on the precipice of complete deterioration, if not already there. So, I mean, the war in Syria is less than 50 miles away, and Beirut is a city that's still making headlines for keeping it together despite everything. And I think that's commendable, but which is why it sort of also questions, again, the response to Paris. I mean, it's not like we're a city where war is happening all the time. War, the last time we were at war was almost more than 25 years ago. And today we're a city of peace, well, at least we try to be. And such things disturb us and they change how we live. So it's sort of nice. It's nice if someone recognized our plight every now and then.
Dr. Faris, what would you tell people in Paris today? I know there's a lot of concern. We've heard it on our program today and a lot of frayed nerves.
Well, I tell them in French, vous avez une magnifique ville, je l'aime trop, et je veux la visiter prochainement.
You have a fantastic city, I love it a lot, and I'll visit it soon.
Yep.
That's very, very encouraging from somebody who lives in Beirut. What would you say in terms of not focusing on these dark spots for people in Paris? I mean, how do you tell them?
I think I would tell them, from someone who has been through that before, to always seek out normality, to always look at the bright side of things, that things will get better. And in a few days or in a few months, the city will heal. And then the places where such mayhem happened will become landmarks whereby you remember, you always remember, but you will move on in a way that you know will be better for you and for your city. It's important for them to learn, to draw lessons from what happened and not go back or not fall to the agenda that these terrorist groups want to incur with such attacks. Rise above, think of your city, think of your own people, and try to move forward rather than back.
Eli Faris, a physician who blogs from Beirut. Very wise words there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also in Beirut, today anyway, is Jonathan Geyer. He's a fellow at the Institute of Current World Affairs in Cairo. We often speak with him on The World because he blogs about Arabic comics and caricature at Cartoon. So, Jonathan, it so happens you're in Beirut at a conference about Arabic comics. Any discussion about the reaction to Paris versus the reaction to Beirut and how much attention was poured onto the attacks in Paris, relatively speaking?
Well, Marco, that's a conversation I've heard a lot on social media, but I think in person, the Lebanese are a very resilient people. Of course, there's a very rich connection between Paris and Beirut, and I saw one cartoon this morning in the Lebanese newspaper Safir of the country Lebanon, a map of Lebanon, looking in the mirror and seeing the map of France and saying, you know, my dear mother, I hope that you heal. And I think this really is about a connection between two cities more than a divisive set of events. And it shows that terror, when any place in the world is struck, has an impact globally.
So as someone who follows cartoons and satire across the Arab and Muslim world, Jonathan, what have you seen in terms of images and kind of opinion cartoons since Friday?
One of the most powerful images I saw was from Anwar, who's a young cartoonist from Egypt. And it's just this man wiping blood off of a window, and it's just covered in this bright red blood. Now, the caption of this cartoon from Anwar, the Egyptian artist, says, from Baghdad to Beirut to Paris. And my reading of it is that all blood is the same blood, whether it's Iraqi blood, Lebanese blood, or Parisian blood. And it's this unifying message of, you know, when one of us suffers, we all suffer.
What about ISIS? Are there any differences in how ISIS is portrayed in editorial cartoons in the Arab and Muslim world, to say, in Europe or North America?
Well, for the past year or more, Marco, we've seen just an outpouring of satire about ISIS, making fun of their so-called piety, making fun of their really disgusting tactics, and also just using them as a punchline as one would any villain. So there's really no red line in the Middle East about making fun of ISIS.
Also, what about calls from the West for governments in the Mideast to take ISIS much more seriously? Do cartoonists have something to say about that?
I think what cartoonists say here in the Middle East, and I don't like to generalize too much, but whether in Egypt or Lebanon, terrorism is just a fact of life. So there's one very powerful cartoon by an Egyptian artist, Walid Taher, of the word terrorism literally spelling out a man's arm and his friend's leg, and terrorism just being a part of life. So I don't think there's a huge resonance of these Western calls for Arab governments to do more. However, what I would say is there's also a whole genre of conspiracy comics, which are totally ridiculous, that show ISIS as, you know, the puppetry of the West or a Zionist conspiracy. And obviously these are ridiculous notions, but they actually appear quite a lot in the Arab press.
I mean, we're talking about cartoons here, and cartoons we know are supposed to be funny. They're supposed to kind of make us think and make us smile at the same time. After Friday's attacks on Paris, you wrote about the dilemma cartoonists and satirists face in responding to terrorist attacks.
Marco, what I would say is it's very difficult to encapsulate the complexity and nuance of an attack, whether it be on Paris or Beirut or Baghdad. And what many, many artists and illustrators do is dumb it down and make it about the colors of a flag. And what I've really been struck by in Algerian cartoonist Lahik, Anwar, as I mentioned, are cartoonists that are going beyond the flag and showing that when one person feels pain and suffering, we all do. I would love to see more comics and cartoons that take on personal reactions of what's happened and how people feel about it, that goes beyond simple notions of nation states.
Jonathan Geyer, Cairo-based writer who blogs at Cartoon, joining us from Beirut. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The Paris attacks have a lot of people rattled, and not just in France. Right here in the Boston area today, Harvard University evacuated four campus buildings after receiving a bomb threat. Probably not related at all, but you never know. And also today, a new ISIS video threatened that the group would hit Washington just as it did Paris. So could it happen here? Juliet Kayyem is a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and an analyst here with our partners at WGBH. I asked her if this was a scenario she prepared for when she was a counterterrorism official.
Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, to the extent that this does replicate Mumbai and what happened in Mumbai in terms of these multiple attacks.
The attack on the Taj Hotel and numerous sites.
And simultaneously in an urban environment. I think, however, you know, we had sort of people in counterterrorism had sort of gotten used to this notion of the lone wolf. So they're scary, but their impact is quite limited. What we saw happen on Friday wasn't beyond the pale of imagination whatsoever. I think what's surprising is the extent to which something like that could be planned, organized, paid for, implemented with near perfection. And it appears, you know, barely any intelligence to suggest it was about to happen.
I mean, there have been suggestions that there was chatter in intel circles that something might happen imminently in France. I mean, how do people in intelligence react to chatter like that? And how much chatter is there? I mean, there must be lots of it at any given time.
That's the problem, is that there is so much chatter. And if you look at a country like France, which is probably monitoring a couple thousand people who've been to Syria, they now have a refugee influx. Its capacity at this stage, and it's just the breadth of the potential threat. So in every terrorist incident, there is always going to be chowder found after the fact. It's inevitable, right, that something was picked up. The problem was that the different pieces weren't put together. And just to make it clear, there are three pieces to any terrorism incident, right? There's, and we sort of call it ATM. There's the arms, the training, and the money. And so those three things are all being implemented by the terrorists. And the fact that none of those pieces were picked up apparently with any precision by French or international intelligence agencies is surprising.
But when their forces of law and order get serious, they can be pretty aggressive,
yeah.
Can't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone is talking about all these arrests that happened overnight. These are overbroad arrests. There is no doubt in my mind that the success rate or who they get is probably going to be just a percentage of who they've gone after. These are broad sweeps. These are preventative detention. And this is how France is going to work right now until they figure out what happened in this incident, but also to ensure that something more doesn't happen.
Right. Well, very sensitive moment right now, and far be it for me to say what is an overreach in that respect. What about the overreaction on the surveillance front?
Yeah.
Edward Snowden showed the world the breadth and the scope of surveillance. Washington pulled back on that.
Yeah.
Now what?
So did Europe.
And that's
exactly right. I mean, the Europeans were not too happy upon learning
recently the French Parliament, coincidentally, happened to be talking about possibility of expanding it again.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I think that you see these pendulum swings back and forth, and you're starting to hear these discussions about whether the post-Snowden release about the bulk data collection had the pendulum swing too far one way so that surveillance was limited.
So in Paris, one explosive device was intercepted by a routine security search at the stadium, Stade de France. What lessons can be learned from the security measures like that? I mean, that did work.
It not only worked, it saved hundreds of lives. I do a lot in sports security consulting, because the challenge of sports security, as we certainly saw with the Boston Marathon here in Boston, is you want things to flow, you want people to have a good time, but you actually, the obligation is to keep them safe. And so, you know, when we go through those checkpoints, it's for a reason. And so not only was the pat down that led to the visualization or the recognition that he was wearing a vest save lives, but the decision to do staggered evacuation was absolutely brilliant from my perspective, from someone in crisis management, because they didn't know who might be surrounding it. If everyone went through every exit, you just couldn't secure those exits. So what they did is they did a staggered evacuation where they could secure one or two exits and let people out. And it was a lesson learned from other incidences, and it saved, I think, a lot of lives.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive. Juliet, finally, you're a mom,
yeah.
And I've encountered as a parent what must be a common question for American parents this weekend. What do you say to your kids? And we've been talking very much from the brain here. But what do you say to your kids when they ask, can it happen here? Will it happen here?
I tell them, as I told them this weekend, that it can, but that people are working really hard to reduce the risk of the likelihood and to fortify places that might be dangerous, but that we live in a risky society and sometimes that's not so bad. So I remind them of how great it is to travel and to go to a Patriots game and to enjoy being a kid in America, because we are, despite our own fears and everything going on in the world, we are still relatively safe.
Juliet Kayyem, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Julia Kayyem is a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and an analyst with our partners here at WGBH. Before last Friday, had you done a search for Bataclan on YouTube, you'd have found some enjoyable videos. Not so today. The Bataclan is a beautiful little Parisian concert hall, seats about 1,500, built in 1864. Its design echoes the Far East, a style known as chinoiserie. It's had Maurice Chevalier and Edith Piaf on its stage. It also hosted Buffalo Bill Cody and Prince. It became a kind of legendary venue for rock bands to play, like the Velvet Underground in 1972.
I want to sing a last song now. If I can, I try my best.
Lead singer Nico, again, this is 1972, so everyone in the theater was smoking, and Nico apparently was having trouble with the air that night.
I don't smoke cigarettes.
The French seem to appreciate that. Today, though, no applause. The owners of the theater in the 11th arrondissement of Paris said today they can't even express their grief for what happened there. We'll leave you today with sounds from happier times at the Bataclan. Here's the Velvet Underground with I'll Be Your Mirror. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
I find it hard to believe you don't know. But if you don't, let me be your eyes and in your darkness, so you won't be afraid when you think the night has seen your mind and inside you're twisted and unkind. Let me stand and show that you are blind. Please put down your head.
PRI, Public Radio International.